This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Bookmark on the Bigger Picture. I'm Umar Pagan Ampake Pagan, and this is the very first episode of the challenge I set myself last week. 50 books in 50 weeks, or my year of reading recklessly. The highbrow, the lowbrow, the classics, the cult, good books, great books, all in an attempt at putting together some sort of definitive reading list, because it was Calvino who once wrote, "All that can be done is for each one of us to invent our own ideal library of our classics." First up, something a little familiar. A literary institution, the most adapted fictional character in history, Sherlock Holmes. Basil Rathbone, Jeremy Brett, Robert Downey Jr., Tom Baker, Benedict Cumberbatch, the consulting detective has been depicted on the big and small screen more than 254 times. Hamlet's only got 206 under his belt. The reason I'm starting with Arthur Conan Doyle and his enduring creation is because Sherlock Holmes is an ideal example of literature that's so pervasive. I mean, he's everywhere. In movies, on television, in comic books, in 1,000 spin-offs from Laurie R. King to Michael Chabon, we reference him, we misquote him, and yet many of us haven't really read him.
About the Sherlock Holmes stories, it came about in this way. I was quite a young doctor at the time. I had, of course, a scientific training, and I used occasionally to read detective stories. It always annoyed me how in the old-fashioned detective story, the detective always seemed to get at his results either by some sort of lucky chance or a fluke, or else it was quite unexplained how he got there. He got there, but he never gave an explanation how. Well, that didn't seem to me quite playing the game. It seemed to me that he's bound to give his reasons why he came to his conclusions. Well, once I began to think about this, I began to think of turning scientific methods, as it were, onto the work of detection. And I used, as a student, to have an old professor, his name was Bell, who was extraordinarily quick at deductive work. He would look at the patient, he would hardly allow the patient to open his mouth, but he would make his diagnosis of the disease, and also very often of the patient's nationality and occupation and other points, entirely by his power of observation. So naturally, I thought to myself, well, if a scientific man like Bell was to come into the detective business, he wouldn't do these things by chance. He'd get the thing by building it up scientifically. So, having once conceived that line of thought, you can well imagine that I had, as it were, a new idea of the detective, and one which it interested me to work out. I thought of 100 little dodges, as you may say, 100 little touches by which he could build up his conclusions, and then I began to write stories on those lines.
Now, that was probably one of the only surviving interviews with Conan Doyle about Holmes and his inspiration for him. Every generation knows Holmes, and it always feels a little bit like we're rereading Holmes, when in fact, so few of us have actually read him in the first place. Literary Doyle has become a victim of its own success, which brings us to this week's selection, The Sign of Four.
Jonathan Small.
Mahomet Singh.
Abdullah Khan.
Dost Akbar. The Four.
Holmes was the subject of four novels: The Study in Scarlet, The Sign of Four, The Hound of the Baskervilles, The Valley of Fear, and 56 short stories by Arthur Conan Doyle. So why the second book? Why not A Study in Scarlet? Why not start at the very beginning? Because this is Holmes at his most familiar. He is no longer the newly minted consulting detective of A Study in Scarlet. In The Sign of Four, we see Holmes at his most confident, irresistibly drawn to the plight of his client Mary Morstan, a beautiful woman plagued by a mysterious past.
Briefly, the facts are these. My father was an officer in the 34th Bombay Infantry.
Ah.
Dr. Watson?
The doctor has also served in India.
Oh.
Yes. Pray continue.
My mother died when I was a child, and I was sent home to England to live. I was placed in a boarding establishment in Edinburgh, and I remained there until I was 17. My father obtained 12 months' leave and came home to London, telegraphing me that he had arrived all safe, and directing me to come down at once to the Langham Hotel. His message was full of kindness and love. I drove to the Langham and was informed that Captain Morstan had gone out the night before and had not returned. I waited all day, but there was no news of him. And that night, on the advice of the manager of the hotel, I communicated with the police.
Yeah.
Their inquiries led to no result, and nothing more has been heard of my unfortunate father.
Holmes occupies center stage for almost all of the supremely satisfying tale of detection, while Watson comes into his own in a case that shows Sherlock steeped in his drugs and ends with the breakup of their shared lodgings in Baker Street. There's drama, there's detection, there's genuine character development. It's The Empire Strikes Back. Now, only 7 years have passed since the events of A Study in Scarlet, but Holmes seems, in the interim, to have accumulated a lifetime's worth of experience, which he brings to bear on this incredibly cinematic adventure. It's rooted in the Indian Mutiny of 1857, stolen jewels from Agra, and a Sikh plot. There's the occult, there's a dependable dog, there's even a breathless chase down the Thames. Murder, robbery, betrayal, revenge, it's vintage Holmes, no pun intended. But how did The Sign of Four come about? Well, the story goes that in the summer of 1889, the managing editor of the American magazine Lippincott's, Joseph M. Stoddard, visited London to commission a new fiction from some up-and-coming authors. On 30th August, he held a dinner at the Langham Hotel, attended by Oscar Wilde and Arthur Conan Doyle, among others. Now, Stoddard's initial idea was to produce an English version of his magazine with local British contributors. In the end, only Doyle, with his typical professionalism and efficiency, delivered his copy on time for its British publication on February 1890. On its first magazine appearance, the novel was titled The Sign of the Four, following the description of the fatal symbol of murder in the text of the story. After that, during several serializations in a variety of regional journals, the novel became known as The Sign of Four. Like its prequel, A Study in Scarlet, published in 1888, The Sign of Four was not an overnight success. It was Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories, published in The Strand magazine after 1890, that really made Holmes a literary immortal.
At first, I think they attracted very little attention. But after a time, when I began the short adventures, one after the other, coming out month after month in The Strand magazine, people began to recognize that it was different to the old detective, that there was something there which was new. They began to buy the magazine, and it prospered, and so I may say did I. We both came along together, and from that time, Sherlock Holmes fairly took root. I've written a good deal more about him than I ever intended to do, but my hand has been rather forced by kind friends who continually wanted to know more. And so it is that this monstrous growth has come out of what was really a comparatively small seed.
A side note, the result of Joseph M. Stoddard's dinner in London also had one other remarkable consequence, Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray, which I'm sure we'll get to in the weeks to come. But back to the story. Mary Morstan, the client, presents herself in Baker Street. Her father, an Indian Army captain, has gone missing. And there's a second puzzle. She reports that over the last several years, on July 7th, she's received 6 pearls in the mail from an unknown source. Mary Morstan can offer the great detective only one clue: a map of a fort found in her father's desk with the names of 3 Sikhs and a certain Jonathan Small. It is, of course, more than enough. The plot that Holmes swiftly unravels will involve some potent aspects of India and all its mystery and romance. It is only his second outing in a full-length novel, and Holmes is already on top form throughout, stimulated, of course, by injections of cocaine and his celebrated deductive method.
You mentioned your name just now as if I should recognize it, but I can assure you, beyond the obvious facts, that you are a bachelor, a solicitor, and a Freemason, and an asthmatic. I know nothing about you whatever.
How often have I said to you that when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth? And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice of the master. The Sign of Four also deepens the Holmes-Watson bromance. It also includes a little romance with the good doctor falling in love with the client, Mary Morstan. And they will, of course, eventually get married. The influences of Wilkie Collins are unmistakable. And while The Sign of Four may not be as good a crime novel as The Moonstone, it is the most influential step in the evolution of Holmes and Watson. So we're taking a look at Arthur Conan Doyle and The Sign of Four. This is Bookmark, 50 books in 50 weeks. You're listening to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Bookmark on the Bigger Picture. I'm Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan, and today it's the first episode of my 2015 challenge to consume 50 books in 50 weeks, my year of reading recklessly. Sherlock Holmes took his bottle from the corner of the mantelpiece and his hypodermic syringe from its neat Morocco case.
With his long, white, nervous fingers, he adjusted the delicate needle and rolled back his left shirt cuff. For some little time, his eyes rested thoughtfully upon the sinewy forearm and wrist, all dotted and scarred with innumerable puncture marks. Finally, he thrust the sharp point home and
pressed down the tiny piston and sank back into the velvet-lined armchair with a long sigh of satisfaction. How could you ever stop reading anything that begins like that? Today we're tackling Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, in particular his second big adventure, The Sign of Four. The Sign of Four was written in 1890, but it was set in 1888, which is the same year as the Jack the Ripper murders. In fact, by modern standards, the distance between 221B Baker Street, where Sherlock and Watson live, and the Whitechapel district is less than 10 kilometres apart. The living conditions of the East End of London, even before the Whitechapel murders, could be described as that great cesspool into which all loungers and idlers of the empire are irresistibly drained. Naturally, after the Ripper killings, the public were in a panic. And here comes the literary hero, here to fight crime, dispense justice, and protect the streets of London. Here comes Sherlock Holmes.
Well, Watson, I should say this watch belonged to your eldest brother, who inherited it from your father. Your brother was untidy and careless. He was left with good prospects, lived for some time in poverty with occasional bursts of prosperity. Then finally taking to drink, he died.
Holmes, this is unworthy of you. You must have already made inquiries into the history of my unhappy brother. Surely you don't expect me to believe you have read all this from his old watch?
My dear doctor, pray accept my apologies. I was merely stating what I had deduced from an examination of the watch. I never even knew you had a brother until you handed the watch to me.
Then how in the name of all that is wonderful did you get those facts?
I could only say what was the balance of probability. You wish to test my powers of observation and deduction in relation to the watch, so I will tell you why I reached my conclusions. On the back are the initials HW and the year 1830. The second initial suggests the owner's name was Watson, and the date would indicate that the watch was originally given to your father. As jewelry is usually left to the eldest son, the watch has no doubt been in the hands of your brother, who was a careless man, as is evidenced by the dents in the case. A man invariably winds his watch at night before going to bed, and the number of scratches near the keyhole indicate to me that he had difficulty inserting the key, which in turn suggests that he was frequently drunk when he tried to do so. Your brother also suffered hard times with occasional bursts of prosperity. If you open the back of the watch, you will see a number of pawnbroker's marks scratched on the inside.
That is truly remarkable and quite true. It amazes me how you can learn so much from so little.
Elementary, my dear Watson, elementary.
And he is different from all your other detectives, not because of his superhuman reasoning skills, but rather his abiding ennui, his utter despair with what the rest of us would call life. His only salvation is that famed 7% solution of diluted cocaine that kept him from jumping off the top of Big Ben into the filthy streets below him. That, and the challenges offered by crime, how it teases and taxes his existence into a diverting meaning.
My mind rebels at stagnation. Give me problems. Give me work. Give me the most abstruse cryptogram, the most intricate analysis, and I'm in my proper atmosphere. Then I can dispense with artificial stimulants. But I abhor the dull routine of existence. I crave mental exaltation. That is why I've chosen my own profession, or rather, created it. But I am the only one in the world.
Now, Sherlock Holmes is not the first fictional detective. C. Auguste Dupin, hero of a bunch of stories by Edgar Allan Poe, came before. It was Poe that invented the classic formula, the super smart private detective and his less smart but more literary narrator buddy, amazing leaps of logic that proved to be right, and a bumbling cop who could never seem to quite get things right. Which in itself is a variation on a theme best known to literature in a double act like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza.
Holmes!
What is it?
I want to ask you something. Well? If I'm to continue as your chronicler, I want to make sure that I present your methods accurately.
Yes, good.
Observation and deduction. I've heard you say that it's difficult for a man to have any object in daily use without somehow impressing his individuality on it.
Yes, well, give it to me, Watson.
I beg your pardon?
The object, the test piece, whatever it is. And I cannot emulate a music hall mind reader. I do not work blindfolded.
Here. This has recently come into my possession. What can you tell me about its previous owner?
Well, I can tell you that his watch has prevented me from taking another dose of cocaine, as you so transparently intended it should. Yes, now.
The Holmes stories are, of course, narrated by Watson. He is our guide through this world of mystery and mayhem of 19th century Britain. In an introduction to the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, Jean Le Carré writes, "Dr. Watson doesn't write to you. He talks to you. With Edwardian courtesy across a glowing fire. His voice has no barriers or affectations. It is clear, energetic, and decent, the voice of a tweedy, no-nonsense colonial Britisher at ease with himself. Its owner is travelled. He is knocked about, as they say, browned his knees. Yet, he remains an innocent abroad. He is a first-class chap, loyal to a fault, brave as a lion, and the salt of the earth. All the clichés fit him, but he is not a cliché."
Holmes. You're early.
Fashionably.
Miss Mary Mawson.
Oh, my goodness. What a pleasure. For the life of me, I don't know why it's taken him so long to introduce us properly.
Pleasure is mine. It really is quite a thrill to meet you, Mr. Holmes. I've heard so much about you. I have a pile of detective novels at home, Wilkie Collins, Poe.
It's true.
It can seem a little far-fetched, though, sometimes, making these grand assumptions out of such tiny details.
That's not quite right, is it? In fact, the little details are by far the most important. Take Watson.
I intend to.
See his walking stick, a rare African snake wood, hiding a blade of fire tensile steel. A few were awarded to veterans of the Afghan War, so I can assume. He's a decorated soldier. Strong, brave, born to be a man of action.
And?
Neat, like all military men. Now, I check his pockets. Ah, a stub from a boxing match. Now, I can infer that he's a bit of a gambler. I'd keep an eye on that dowry if I were you.
Those days are behind me.
Right behind you. It's cost us the rent more than once.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Holmes, you know John very well. What about a complete stranger? What can you tell about me?
You?
I don't think that's...
I don't know that that's...
Not a dinner.
Perhaps some other time.
I insist.
You insist?
You remember we discussed this.
The lady insists.
Watson is one of the greatest storytellers the world has ever listened to. Holmes, on the other hand, is mercurial. He is brilliant, he is complex, he is turbulent, and he is not safe out there alone. He manages, sure. He can detect, he can deduce. He can disguise himself that would fool Jim Phelps. He can troll opium dens and wrestle Moriarty off a cliff's edge, but he's still only half the fellow he becomes whenever Watson's around. It's no wonder that the pairing of Holmes and Watson has triggered more imitators than any other duo in literature. Contemporary cop dramas draw on them repeatedly. They're almost single-handedly responsible for the buddy flick. The modern thriller would be lost without them. There would be no George Smiley or Peter Guillam. There would be no Batman and Robin. There would be no Jeeves and Wooster.
What? Well, I know it's inconvenient, but you really mustn't let it affect you like this.
Whatever do you mean?
You are sitting there, boiling with indignation because you have been forced to leave the warmth and comfort of 221B by the ardour of Mrs. Hudson's spring cleaning.
Oh, my dear Watson, however did you deduce that?
By simply applying your methods, Holmes.
Indeed.
You'll agree that you are not here for either a shave or a haircut.
That is true. How did you know?
Because you invariably shave yourself. And you are patently not due for a haircut for another 2 weeks.
Correct.
And you left our rooms in some haste? You are without either your gloves or your cane.
Go on.
Well, I know that Mrs. Hudson has been trying to complete her spring cleaning all day. Now, you have been sitting there, frowning, eyes tightly closed, grinding your teeth, and all the time your fingers have been drumming like pistons on the arm of that chair. So, given all this evidence, even I cannot fail to deduce that you have quarrelled with our good housekeeper and sought refuge in the sanity of the barber's shop. You cannot deny that I am right.
Ah, Watson, you could not be further.
The idea, of course, is that these characters are real, that Holmes and Watson really lived in Victorian London, in what is now an HSBC on Baker Street. The idea, of course, is that John H. Watson wrote these stories about his dear friend Sherlock Holmes and graciously allowed them to be published under the byline of his colleague and literary agent, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It is a gentle fiction, but one that I'm more than happy to perpetuate. Next time on Bookmark, on 50 Books in 50 Weeks, we're doing Dickens. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.